Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most daring, dangerous, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners, or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons learned through their experience. I'm Phil, here with Brian, your host, and we welcome you aboard They Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association. Hey guys, thanks for tuning again to our latest episode. This one's episode 3, and I think we got a hell of a good one for you today.
Phil, I am so excited to talk to this guy today. You have no idea.
Yeah, our guest today is a kind of a legend among the training center staff and the bosun mate rating. I'm going to go ahead and intro him before we start letting him talk.
Let's do this, bro.
All right. Senior Chief Bosun Mate Retired Thomas Rooks. Three-time Coast Guard Commendation Medal winner, officer in charge, and most importantly, the Bosun Mate A School Chief, responsible for shaping the minds and skills of hundreds, if not thousands,
the young
of
lads coming
mates.
Out.
Yeah. Just recently retired last year, joined the Coast Guard back in 96. First assignment was the Coast Guard Honor Guard up in D.C., performing all manner of ceremonies for the fallen and for state visits and stuff. Went from there, made a huge mistake and joined Quartermaster Ace, the Quartermaster rating, but we'll talk about that. We remedied that later on in his career. First operational assignment was the Coast Guard Cutter Campbell.
That's out of New Bedford, Massachusetts.
Yeah, New Bedford, Mass. Went from there to Coast Guard Cutter Long Island in San Diego, and got to make the trip transferring that thing up to Valdez, Alaska, which is that's basically the entire West Coast.
Right, that was a hell of a trip.
Yeah, on a 110-foot cutter. That might be another episode.
Yeah.
Cool thing on Long Island happened to him. One day he woke up and he was a bosun mate. They dissolved the quartermaster rating because they found out that bosun mates basically do all the work anyway, and that's what he became.
We accepted him with open arms.
Yeah, with open arms. Right? So, you know, you can just notice talent, and he had it, I guess. After the Long Island, after becoming a BM, he went to Station Bellingham out in Washington, served as XPO there, or Executive Petty Officer for a while, number 2 spot. Went from there to Station Jonesport up in Maine. Apparently he likes the cold. Again, as the Executive Petty Officer. And then final operational assignment was as the officer in charge at Station Houston, which I understand that he stood that whole unit up. It was a brand new one, so
right.
He got to create it out of nothing.
Plank owner.
From there, where I met him, had the pleasure of meeting him, was at Bosun Mate A School down in Training Center Yorktown.
Yep.
Where he was the school chief for at least 3 or 4 years or so, and then came down as the lead instructor for all underway training. Job with a lot of responsibility, and one that he performed well and set the bar for all future people to ever do it, without a doubt.
Right. Yeah, I met him at Training Center Yorktown. I was actually going through the CCTI process, and so actually my first interactions with him, and he made quite an impression on me, told me some good advice to carry on in my career, and I'm just, Tom, I can't thank you enough for doing this for me, man.
Thanks.
Or us, and let's just kick this off. Why don't you tell us one of your most daring, epic, or dangerous stories for us?
Yeah, thanks for that introduction, boy. That guy sounds pretty cool. I'd like to meet him one day. The story that came to mind, I thought about telling because basically pretty much everybody that's been on the same class or ship it happened on has seen the video footage of the incident. So it's nice to fill in the full picture so that people can see the context of the situation we were in. So basically, this all comes down to we're somewhere a couple hundred miles off the coast of Honduras, Nicaragua border. And like every Coast Guard ship, I'd been bored for years. You know, we're doing fisheries boarding. You're counting monkfish livers in a fish hole in 10-foot seas, kind of, you know, is that real be a part of the action kind of job.
Strangely enough, you're a QM at this point.
Yes, right? Yes.
Yeah. I was back on the QM. Yeah, back on the
QM. So, you know, I actually think being a QM encouraged me to do more stuff than I would have if I started as a Mosin mate, because I quickly realized how boring and nerdy what I was doing was. And so any kind of special assignment I could get, any kind of like getting
collateral duty on that duty, ship, yeah. You volunteered
for, right? I had 28 different jobs, man, because it got me to at least feel kind of cool. So we decided to change out the rescue, the cutter boat swimmer, cutter rescue swimmer, whatever they called it. They decided to change that person out.
What does that guy do?
That person, well, to my knowledge, they basically hung out on the mess deck playing cards during flight ops.
Right.
That was what I thought the job
what
was.
What are they supposed to do?
All I know is they weren't on the bridge, which is where I spent too many hours. And no, their job is if somebody were to go overboard, if there needed to be a rescue from a small boat, any incident that the cutter itself, which is, you know, fairly large, not for our Navy friends, but fairly large. Anything where the cutter itself can't really get it done, the rescue swimmer would theoretically jump in the water and, you know, save people's lives. And so it sounded like a pretty cool job to me. I'd actually wanted to be a rescue swimmer when I joined, but the wait for the school at that point was 5 years, and I was already married. So 5 years to hopefully make you
somebody
fool was
wouldn't.
Not... No, nah, that wouldn't have worked.
One of you guys wasn't going to be happy with that wait.
I would have been happy and single. So I try out for the rescue swimmer job, and the funny part is I got my qualification letter the day of the incident. So at muster that day, I officially became a rescue swimmer.
Wow.
And it was, we were doing...
There was a little competition for the job too, right?
Oh, yeah. There was actually 9 guys wanted it for whatever reason. I think, you know
there's no extra pay either, right?
No, not, like, a dollar. Yeah, no,
just,
not a dollar.
Just
no,
the glory of being...
No, the only extra pay was for those Bosun Mate Mafia members that did the tie-down work. You know, if they got the exact amount of tie-downs...
The way it's done.
That mighty 75 extra dollars.
Hey, every little bit counts.
Yeah, everything counts. And I wasn't, you know, they didn't welcome me into that mafia. So, yeah, I competed for the job of rescue swimmer. It was hilarious because it was like a really half-hearted NFL combine filled with broad jumps and shuttle runs on a flight deck of a small ship, you know. But, they, you know, we did what we could, and I somehow came away with the gig. And so that evening, we were going to do flight ops. We had to do 16 touch and goes. I remember specifically that. And it was going to be sunset, so we're going to get daytime and then going into night. That way, you know, everybody could make their hazard pay and we'd be competent or whatever.
And for these cutters, just for anybody that hadn't seen it, right, like a 210, right, they carry a helo on the back when one's deployed with them, and they use a helicopter, search and rescue, law enforcement, whatever. I don't know what a touch and go is because I'm a helo guy.
You can go ahead and explain.
Yeah, well, it was a 270-footer, and like you said, Phil, we'd get a helo crew from some air station for a couple of weeks to just be aboard our ship for a while. And touch and goes when they would practice just landing and then taking off again. So they're not shutting down in between takeoffs. They're not getting tied down to the deck. They're not, you know, so it's quite what it sounds like. They're just practicing touching deck, making sure they're safe, and then lifting off again. So it's a good way to get a lot of reps for their pilots and for crews.
And it's landing on a ship floating at sea in a helicopter. Yeah.
Well, it's moving.
Yeah.
It's rocking.
Not,
so it's
not easy.
Even if it's flat,
no.
A ship is never calm.
Right.
You know, there's always something moving the ship. So
it's like it wasn't meant to be. You really shouldn't be landing helicopters.
No, it shouldn't be. And about a year prior to the incident, the irony is we actually had a helicopter almost go overboard. It touched. We were in rough seas, and it touched down, and then our ship moved away from underneath it. And it sort of bounced over to the side of the ship and then went over on two wheels. Oof. And the footage that didn't make it to print on that was there was actually a person in the backseat of the helo leaning, trying to get the helicopter to come down from its...
And you were on board the Camel for that incident,
Yeah,
too,
so
huh?
When that happened, we thought, oh, God, people are going to die here. But then, you know, everything worked out. You forget about it with time and you go back
to work.
Were
you on the bridge when that happened?
I was on the bridge when that
so
happened.
So you had the camera.
Oh,
so
yeah.
You actually saw everything.
Yeah, that was pretty... It was pretty sketchy, and that air crew was so freaked out by that we pulled in close enough to shore, and they flew off, and
I can
they refused to be.
They were done. They were like, yeah. It's over.
Yeah, they were done.
Training time out, right?
They were done. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, they called their wives on the.
They didn't even wait for the boss to be like, "You're not trying that again." No, just like, we're done.
Yeah, once you've been on two wheels staring at the sea in a helicopter, I think, you know, it's probably time to move on. And so that night we're doing helo ops, and I decided, like, I was like, okay, the least I can do to honor the job is to like work out, because I think that's what swimmers are supposed to be, really strong, and so I might as well like work out. That'll be my thing. So while we're doing helo ops, I'm back in my office working out, which is just above the hangar, and I'm counting, you know, there's nothing to do but count hours, time, minutes, reps, drills when you're at sea. And so I'm counting the reps, and sure enough, on the very last touch and go, which means we're going to shut down for the night, I hear the helo land, and you can tell from the sound it makes whether or not they're kind of powering down. So it touches, they're going to power down, which means the tie down crew, which is I think six guys, are going to come run out and strap the thing to the deck. And right at that moment, we took a rogue wave. And I'd never actually experienced a true rogue wave before.
It's the beauty of the North Atlantic.
You hear right about there. Them, and some people dispute if they exist, and those people have not spent enough time at sea. But sure enough, I'm doing my crunches, and we rolled a starboard. Maybe, I don't know, felt like 90 degrees. But
this is like the third rogue wave story.
Right,
yeah.
Right,
everybody's got a rogue
right.
wave.
So next, well, all I know is I'm doing my crunches, and all of a sudden that one was really hard to do. Right, so. As the ship goes down to the side, I realized, because of the sound the helo had made, that it was on deck. Like, it wasn't going to be able to lift off. So I quickly muttered a slew of profanity, knowing something was going to go wrong. And then the next thing I heard was one of the loudest noises I've ever heard, which was the banging of the helicopter blades against the garage door of the hangar.
Oh.
If anybody's ever hit a tennis ball when they were a kid against their mom and dad's garage door, which, mm-hmm. you know, I used to play against the garage all the time, that banging on that aluminum door rattling. Well, this door is, I don't know, 15, 20 feet tall. It's a big door. And helicopter blades hitting at velocity shook my world.
Yeah.
So I jumped down on deck.
No, at that point in time, you knew.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
There's no way this is right.
Distinct enough. Yeah. Like, yeah. Man, something just went wrong.
I knew from the rogue wave that like there was gonna be an outcome that would be memorable.
Yeah,
like,
right.
And then there was no way avoiding that at that point. But then when you hear the helicopter blades, you know you know it was about to be very real. So
are you already dressed out?
No, I'm in my modified underweight uniform, you know, a really sporty t-shirt,
right.
You know, and maybe some shorts. And so I've got to jump down into the hangar. The helicopter hangar is closed when you're doing flight ops. I don't know why, but it is. And inside, the electricians are running the lights. They control the lights so the pilots see different things or shut them off or whatever. So I jump down into the hangar, and the door is closed, and the electricians are looking at me, you know, they're like, what the, you know,
yeah.
They can't see, I don't think they could see what was going on, but then stuff's going on, and they're in a garage that's getting hit by helicopter blades, right? So I've got to get on my wetsuit. In training, I don't think I ever got it on in less than like 2 minutes, but I think roughly 18 seconds into the event,
right.
I was fully dressed out, you know, I don't, probably didn't have any body hair, probably ripped it all off, but whatever, right? So The one of the distinct memories I have, though, is we had been watching on ships back then. You had these little 8mm movies from the Navy that,
right.
you know, and every patrol had a theme. Like, I remember the patrol of Armageddon, where we watched Ben Affleck like nonstop all day, every day.
Ben Affleck movies.
Yeah, Ben Affleck movies, right?
The patrol is Ben Affleck.
So this patrol was the Saving Private Ryan patrol. And so I'm sitting there in my wetsuit, and I've seen Saving Private Ryan, you know, roughly 83 times in 3 days. And so I'm in my wetsuit, and I'm waiting for them to open the door. And what I said to myself out loud repeatedly was, no matter what you see, get to your boat. That night was one of the last times we were going to do flight ops on that patrol. And they let some of my guys I worked with, my lowly quartermaster brethren, they let us work the tie down crew, which was really nice, because that's a $75 pay kicker, you know,
right.
It gets them off the bridge. So I knew my friends were on that tie down crew that was under the helicopter that was now spitting helicopter blades at things. So I remember before the EMs would open the door for me, I just kept saying to myself, no matter what you see.
Right.
And I remember thinking, if you see your best friend torn in half crying for his mom,
you have a job to
just
do
get to your boat. Just like, my job is not the flight deck. My job is get in the small boat, get in the water, pick up parts, pick up friends, do whatever you got to do, right? Make it better. So the helicopter door opens, and the scenery of this, the helicopter is still sort of jitterbugging, like one of those wind-up toys with the little feet that move back and forth. It's on its side, just kind of wandering around on the flight deck.
Because even the
rotor spins.
The rotors are broken off, but it's still spinning.
Yeah, it's still spinning. It's still coming down. And I can see the air crew is fiercely working different levers, which I think I learned later was they were trying to shut off the fuel so it wouldn't leak the fuel, the hundreds of gallons of fuel, all over the flight deck, and then we'd be dead.
Spark, boom.
Yeah, it would be
now you
gone.
Have a...
So I got a helicopter that's jitterbugging around, and then we've already, the firefighters had laid down a layer of AFFF, which is foam. Looks like, you know, well, it's foam. It looks exactly like foam.
Makes water, so, makes foam.
Wouldn't you know it.
Bubble bath.
So they laid down a layer of foam, but it's windy out now. And so the foam is going up into the night sky like the opposite of snow. Like little chunks of foam are blowing off into the
sky.
I'm
getting this like surreal
view. Yeah, that's exactly.
That's an eerie, surreal
feeling.
Absolutely. So the foam's going up in the sky. This helicopter's jitterbugging around on deck. And the gunner's mates, it was like all their dreams fulfilled because they were given carte blanche to light up the sky.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So it looks like the 4th of July. There's flares being launched at a rhythm that I've never seen. I didn't know you could open the canisters that fast, right? So flares are popping off in the night sky as the foam is going up into the air, as the helicopter's jitterbugging around. And whenever we do man overboard drills on a ship, everybody points. You know, everybody's a pointer. Everyone's a pointer. Well, at flight ops, like a third of the crew is on deck, apparently, with the tie-down crews and the firefighters and everything. So In all my memories of doing man overboard, you just look at where everybody's pointing and you look for the man overboard. My problem was everybody was pointing different directions. There's like 10 people out on deck and they're all pointing different directions. It looked like one of those signs you see in the Middle East when armies are deployed, saying like New York is this way, you know,
home
that
this way.
I got 28 different directions I'm supposed to be looking for a man overboard.
Did you know at that point in time that maybe there was more than one man, or were you so new at it that you're just like, oh my God.
I assumed because, you know, there are handrails on a ship that have like cargo nets attached, and they lay them down as like kind of a catch-all. And
like a last barrier you know, because they literally hang over the ocean.
Yeah, they hang over the ocean.
And it's about 30 feet
up. And as that door comes up, I see several people scrambling out of those.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm thinking, there's got to, who knows?
And this picture just gets more surreal by the...
Oh, it is.
I'm also, you know what, I'm also picturing like QM3 Rooks standing in the middle of the flight bay looking stoic, right?
Just qualified.
Just puffed out.
Just like, qualified.
In his rescue swimmer gear.
The world.
Just ready.
Oh, and I really thought, I didn't ever think I'd be a hero, but I was like, I sure as heck don't want to get caught on the wrong side of the moment.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
right.
For whatever I may or may not be able to do, I don't want to get caught on the wrong side of this moment. And apparently the moment has arrived, you know, like, after many
years. It looks
years,
crazy.
After years of boredom, here it is. And, so these guys are calling all the helo nets, and I'm looking for someone to be in charge. Well, no one's really in charge. I mean, there was an ensign on the ship that we all kind of looked up to because he had a previous history in sieges, and he was supposed to be in charge, to my knowledge. But I'm pretty sure he had gone Pentecostal. Like, he was pretty much speaking in tongues, and I don't discredit it for that. Like, I wasn't on the flight deck when helicopter blades started flying and hitting my shipmates, you know?
Yeah.
And so he's like just... Blah, 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 you know, and people are screaming and people are pointing up directions. Guys are crawling all the helo nets. The foam is going. The flares are going. Announcements are being made on the ship's announcement system, but who knows? I mean, all I know is I got to get to my boat. So I get to my boat, get to the small boat off the side, which is like, it had all the seaworthiness of like a clawfoot bathtub with a propeller on the bottom.
Right.
Like it's a motor surf boat, MSB.
MSB.
Yeah. It's
those are the big white ones, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
the
bathtub.
They look like bathtubs.
You can't sink them, but they only go about 3 knots.
Right. Yeah.
And it's on falls, right? So
you have lifelines that hang down.
Yes.
Those lifelines are for the people on the boat.
Yeah. You have lifelines hanging down. And so the boat's over the rail, and I think it's like 15 to 18 feet to the deck. from that moment. So the people in charge aren't there. So this
We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor.
Great. This E3 or whatever, E2, I forget what, you know, if he was E2 or 3 at the time. He had, like, been present for one Boat Evolution. So he decides he's going to launch us because everyone else is doing something else or overboard.
Homino, you're qualified.
Right, yeah. Homino, I missed the bus, you missed the bus, we missed the bus, right? And so we go to get in the boat. Well, first, nobody can find the coxswain. So an extra bosun mate jumps in. But at the same time, an extra bosun mate jumps in, an ensign jumps in because he didn't know there was a bosun mate there. Then they find the coxswain. Then the boat engineer can't be found, but there was another mechanic, another MK that was on the flight deck, so he jumps in the boat. So next thing I know, we go to launch, and we've already got 7 guys in this thing. Like, that was probably the biggest comedy, is everybody's just trying to do the right thing. But, you know, that's, and there's some good lessons learned in this, maybe we'll get to, but... Anyway, we go to launch with 7 guys, and our really elegant launch method is the non-rate release the brakes. So instead of lowering us to the water, well, he lowered us to the water, just at a much more rapid pace than we anticipated.
Yeah, like a falling elevator.
Yeah, and the best part of it is, I guess I was injured, but I didn't know that for about 20 years. Because the best part about concussions is sometimes you don't have to remember them.
Right.
So actually, the chief, one of the guys I pulled out of the water, years later, when I'm here at Yorktown, at the end of my career, calls me. He's like, hey, how'd you ever do with that injury? I was like, what are you talking about, man? He's like, yeah, when you got hurt in the small boat. I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. I never got hurt, man. So he sends me a newspaper article from Miami Herald listing me among the injured with a head wound. All right, concussions.
That, yeah.
Concussions are great. You don't even have to remember them sometimes. And so we free fall to the ocean. And apparently I got beat up from that. I remember bleeding, but I just didn't remember being hurt, if that makes sense. And
what's the sea state out there?
Sea state is now probably, you know, constant 3s, occasional 6s.
Yeah, so
like it's picked up. It's not like, it's not the end of the world, but it's pretty real. And then like anything, it's much more real in the dark, right? It's pitch black, except for the ship, which is lighting off every flare. yeah. So the problem is the BM1, who was the coxswain, or maybe it was BM2 at the time, he is an awesome guy. He is really a great character guy. He's also about a great height of about 5'4". And so the problem is the MSB, being a clawfoot bathtub and waves, he couldn't see where he was going. So I stood in the bow of the thing pointing. Felt like I was George Washington crossing the Delaware. I'm trying to
go that way.
Yeah, let's go this way, right? Like very dramatically, you know.
Somebody needs to paint this whole picture.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, it'd be like the worst painting ever. Like a Jackson Pollock of Coast Guard misery. So we start, we're like, okay, well, where do we go? We don't know. How many guys are in the water? Well, nobody knows that, right? And we just know everybody's pointing and screaming, you know? So we start aiming for blinking lights because, like every man overboard, you throw everything that floats. People are throwing their mattresses just about. You know, like anything that floats, people are putting overboard. So we start going for the blinking lights, and we realize that, you know, okay, so we get to a life ring, no one there. We look around, and there's all these blinking lights. So we go to the next life ring, nobody there. Next life ring, nobody there. And then we're like, wait a second, what if we're just ping-ponging off the same life rings? I mean, there's no, like, GPS tracker telling us that we've... And it's just ocean. It's not like there's a landmark I can base this on. So we had talked about it briefly, and we decided we start pulling the life rings. And the debate was, if a guy is close enough to swim for that life ring to save his life, we should have seen him when we pulled it up. But if we don't start pulling these things up, we might bounce off 3 life rings and have our friends drown. So eventually, after... I don't know. Is it a minute? Is it 40 minutes? It's Coast Guard mishap time. Who knows? You know, it had to be several minutes, I suppose. But we saw a cluster of lights that were really close together, and we pull up on them, and sure enough, it's 3 of our buddies. It's my immediate subordinate, Jeremy Hansen, Chief Allen, who was the landing officer. He was the guy with the cool flashlight wands, and then a BM3 that I played a little bit of music with. I was in one of those horrible shipboard bands that did nothing but Alice. All at that point. That's all like Alice in Chains covers every night. You know, it was like if I had to play Rooster one more time. You know, and so a guy in my band and these guys, and we pull up, and of course they're laughing, and here they are, they're floating off the coast of Honduras, hoping a ship doesn't run them over or not find them,
right?
Either one being bad. And they're laughing. They're having a great time. So we pluck them up, you know, we pull them from the sea, you know, which into the MSB, which, you know, isn't that easy, but heavy, some heavy blokes. But we get back to the ship and we pull back up, and now we got like 10 or 11 guys in here. We have like a good 20% of the ship's total complement of people
in the bathtub,
you know? And of course the falls we broke one of the forward falls where it latches into the bow. Mm-hmm. So that the thing you talked about, the line that comes, there are lines that come down that you pull yourself up. I think mostly just to stabilize yourself, right? You don't have to, but it helps keep the boat guided and keeps you feeling like you're not going to fall
overboard. Or if it free falls, you're just supposed to hold on.
Yeah, hold on to it, right?
You know, that's
a great
invention.
Yeah, so the forward line that's supposed to lift the boat, the latch broke when we hit the deck, right? It wouldn't connect. It wouldn't clip in. So there was no guarantee that thing was going to stay attached to the small boat, which means if we were lifted and it had fallen off, we would have all fallen into the ocean. So I remember looking at this young guy that was young crewman that was in the boat, one of the cast of characters in that small boat for no reason. And I told him, I was like, I'm going to hold your neck. You're going to push against that with everything you got. Like, so you're going to push that thing and hold it in that position no matter what. You just do that, and I'm going to pull us up the ropes. So I got a hold of his shirt by the neck, and I'm pulling us up the man ropes as we come up. And I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, I have this moment that, I'm one hand for the rope, right. The other one for the 400 pounds of man meat, that, you know. But we got up on deck, and there's you know, millions of pieces. The helicopter blades splinter. They like paper shredder, you know, it's just splintered pieces of graphite everywhere. And there's guys bleeding everywhere. And, just a lot of scrapes, and guys were diving on non-skid. Guys were diving across, like looking like Pete Rose sliding into first base for no reason, like, head first sliding against
this even stuff worse. Like, it's a lot worse.
Yeah, even
than
worse.
Than
it's like 20 grit sandpaper, you know. And so guys don't have a lot of skin, and a lot of blood, not a lot of skin. And then, you know, I run up to the bridge and, you know, what do you guys need? Well, get up here. The only guy that, you know, can stand the watch right now that is a navigator, because the other guy just was in the drink and got banged up a little. And so, you know, I go, you know, strip off my wetsuit, get up to the bridge, and, you know, it's time to put an emergency port call to Jamaica. And we realize,
within 15 minutes of you getting on board the ship. So you went to pulling people out of the water.
Yeah.
Figuring their way to get the crew back up on cutter.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And now you're going to have to go navigate the 270 foot, which doesn't maneuver very well.
No, it's time to make, we got to make an emergency port call in Jamaica, and in the next 5 minutes, do the time, speed, distance, figure out exactly when we'll get there, QM1, QM2, whatever it was at that point, who knows, who cares. I guess it was QM3, geez. So that was just the way it was.
As a QM3.
Yeah, well, and that's part of why the Coast Guard got rid of that rate, thank God, was... You know, I got to the ship. We're supposed to have a first-class petty officer, second-class petty officer, two-thirds. I show up, and there's a QM3 named Israel Gomez, who was this spitfire of a dude, man. And it was just me and him. Like, no first, no second, just me and another third, and I'm the one fresh out of school. And he's like, hey, man, in just a few months, you'll be in charge. I'm getting out of this place. So he got out of the Coast Guard. And so, like, 6 months into my tour there, I filled the first-class billet as a third. And they gave me a school graduate and a non-rate, a SNQM, a guy from school that hadn't been in long enough to even officially be promoted to E4, the mighty rank of E4. That guy, that's our staff. And two of them, one of them was in the drink, you know, so.
And having been like the lead of formal Coast Guard training, I get it. Yeah. That's a bad setup.
It's a bad setup, yeah. And that job was always like that. There was never enough folks in the job to fill the billets. So there was never really enough experience. You never really felt like you had a leader. You just, like I said, within 6 months, I was the senior enlisted dude I worked for, you know, and after that I was all officers. And
you learn leadership pretty quickly.
Yeah, you just have to, because nobody's there to do it. Mm-hmm. It's not like it's not anything about the job itself. It's just like everything with the Coast Guard. Our best leadership comes from our shortfalls. You know, it comes from the fact we don't get the boat we wanted or the amount of crew we needed. And that's great. That gives you space to learn to lead. So, yeah, we ended up pulling into Jamaica, then realized they couldn't get the helicopter off the deck. So then we pulled emergency port call into Cuba, and Coast Guard sent a team to make us, like, talk about our feelings and stuff to make sure we weren't freaked out. And in the end, we were angry at those people because we were just shocked. You know, one of the things I always forget to say in the story, no one died. You know, helicopter blades were hitting – it was an all-male crew, so I can just say men. You know, helicopter blades were hitting men. You know, that's
a helo just crashed on a 270 right. foot ship that has 90 personnel, and I would say at any given time, probably 20 of them are around in vicinity where that helo could have killed them.
Yeah, mm-hmm. like one guy's the helmets they wear, like they used to wear in Top Gun. I always, you know, we never did all the high fiving and all that. Nobody ever asked me to be their wingman, but we used to wear those helmets. And
lies.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But the one guy, and I want to say he was a gunner's mate. He got hit twice in the head by helicopter blades that night, and the first time it knocked him to the deck. The second time he dove underneath the grate that holds that small boat. So, not even a foot of height off the ground, there's this grate that that small boat was attached to. He dove under that, face first, to get away from getting hit. When he took off his helmet, the metal plate that was in the back of the helmet was twisted like a pretzel. It was almost 90 degrees twisted from a helicopter blade hitting it.
That helmet definitely saved his life.
Yeah, absolutely. So so here we are getting our therapy session, which I understand people mean well. You know, are you gonna be able to work and tell me what you smelled or heard? You know, they're doing all this stuff, which is good. It's good. It's useful, I guess. But at the time, I was just angry because I was like, we're all just thanking God we're alive. Like. Right. Everyone lived. You know, that is, that's the biggest injury was to one of my Coast Guard heroes, John Cashman, who is, I think, a commander or captain now. He'll probably be commandant one day. He was like truly one of the best officers I ever had the privilege of knowing. And he was the one that dove into the small boat to try and drive it because he wasn't going to let people die, you know, and we didn't know where the coxswain was, his leg. My understanding is he basically blew out his Achilles tendon with trying to run to the small boat in that moment. That was my understanding. And the joke was they tied him down to the dining room table in the wardroom where the officers eat. They tied him down to the table because that was our sick bed on that ship. That's your sick bay. And so the story goes that he was really useful at passing the salt. You know, hey John, could you pass the salt?
Oh, yeah,
thanks, jerk. You know, right. As he's strapped down to the dining room table in the wardroom, you know. But that was probably my most Coast Guard widely known sea story.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
Were you ever scared at any time, or did you not recognize maybe that you could have been scared? Because you were so focused on your mission.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the best parts of the bureaucracy we serve is that you are so filled with the 84 steps of the checklist. Like, it's so rigorously drilled into you.
Right? Get to the boat.
Yeah, just get to the boat. Like I said, my job is get to the boat. Get to the boat. I would have probably jumped over people's body parts because my job was get to the boat. Mm-hmm. And I have a... in my personal life, even before this, I've always been the kind of person where when things are really weird, I'm totally calm, and then I'll go ahead and freak out later. Like, let's just freak out later. Like, we'll let that happen later. So it was probably not till we got home from the patrol like a month later, because we actually kept doing the mission. We seized like 126 migrants on that patrol. We also ended up one of my first boardings as a law enforcement officer on that patrol. We seized a 280 foot cargo ship that was headed from Haiti trying to smuggle stuff. Like, so we kept doing the mission. So I just didn't, you know, it's kind of like some people do this with grieving. I didn't want to it felt self-indulgent to let myself be scared or angry or, like, we'll just do that later. We'll do that when I get home over a beer with my friends, you know. That's probably the best way to handle it.
It sounds like you had a good crew, too. I mean, they're in the water. They're laughing. They're still like, you know, like you said, hey, we survived. Like,
I think they were just happy to be alive.
Yeah.
Well, hey, guys, we're alive. Isn't that great?
It's funny. So one of them swears that a full-speed running very large ensign who played football for the academy knocked him overboard. Not purposefully, but just when an offensive lineman is moving fast and you're built like a backup punter, you lose, right? And then the other guy, my guy dove, like I'm not going to get hit by these blades, but one of the famous images that happened was, and again, this ties into the thank God we're alive part. The chief that had the landing wands, his two flashlights with little plastic things on the end, and he directs the helicopter. So when he dove overboard, and several witnesses on the flight deck said that when he went out away from the ship, he had the flashlights crossed, right? Like, you know, off he goes.
Great.
So he has them crossed in front of him. And several people reported this. It wasn't just one witness, that as soon as his horizontal jump went down, that as soon as he like fell below the surface of the deck, the better part of an entire helicopter blade that was intact went right through the space he had just been in horizontally spinning.
Wow.
It literally would have, I mean, who knows, probably would have cut him in half.
Yeah.
But several witnesses say that, yeah, that like almost an entire helicopter blade went right through that space he had just vacated when he started falling.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, you know, like for as crazy or potentially tragic or life-changing as that event really was, and it was for me, we lived. You know, we weren't supposed to, not everybody's supposed to live, and we did. So in the end, I don't really care about what the mishap lessons were. I don't care what people think of the incident. I don't care if they think we did a great job or we're morons. I don't really care. We all lived.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's, in the end of the day, that's the best I can offer.
Yeah, awesome. That's an amazing story.
Yeah.
Amazing story.
And I'm definitely finding somebody to paint that surreal. Like one day, that's happening. That's going. It's like a CG art program project right there. Somebody can make that happen.
QM3. Disqualified.
Look at him now.
The amount of responsibility that you had, you know, I mean.
That's the best thing about the Coast Guard, right? I mean, that's the reason. The reason I think I joined this branch, because I was considering different options. One of the reasons I joined the Coast Guard was that at the lowest levels, we entrust our people to do things without waiting for Big Brother to tell them it's okay.
Right.
And God, I hope we always are that way. I hope that with the increases in technology and all, you know, all the stuff that makes us able to overwatch each other a little too much, I pray that for the soul of the service, they maintain that goal, that ethos. You know?
Yeah, it's definitely. I've been lucky to be in two separate services, and I fully agree with you that more responsibility goes to junior personnel here than.
Sure.
Brian was a Marine who I'm pretty sure he burned poop, right? Like outside the base. Was that your job?
Did you go to tech school for that? Was that the actual like?
I went to the school where you dig holes in sand and hope people don't shoot you.
Wait, Tom, we so much appreciate you coming on the show today.
Oh, you're welcome.
Amazing story, and I think we'd love to have you back on sometime. Yes. Until I know you got it.
Yeah, yeah. I just want to keep hearing his stories.
Phenomenal storyteller. Sure. Loved it. For the audience, though, what are you into now?
Well, I retired a few months ago. I started a youth rowing program in Williamsburg, the Williamsburg Boat Club, and the program expanded so much. We had 13 kids when we started, 13 high school kids, and now I'm just about at 100 high school athletes.
All right.
And we started a middle school program, and that's growing. And so I retired to become the executive director and head coach. Really, I'm the head coach more than anything else. And it's really fulfilling because I'm basically doing the same thing I was doing on active duty. I'm helping young men and women learn self-discipline and self-actualization by torturing them, you know, encouraging them to suffer immensely all the time. Right. They become stronger.
This man takes rowing so seriously. We used to watch videos at like 1/20th of the speed and just critique people's technique. It's awesome.
He loves swimming. I play water polo with him.
Oh God.
Oh wow. Yeah. Never. Yeah. Again, right?
I consider myself a pretty strong swimmer. But like
he drowned you like a bitch.
It was cheesy. Like he could tread water for like an hour.
Hey, what happens
when not using his arms?
Yeah. Right. Well, what happens in Chief's initiation stays there. Yeah, thought, right. So we'll leave that story another time.
That's funny. Yeah. Well, I know you got a couple projects in the works. We'd like to have you come back on and talk about whenever they're done. And
love to.
Hey, enjoy retirement.
I will. Hopefully, one
day we're there with you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Again, man, thanks so much for coming on. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
We really appreciate
it.
Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org. That's CoastGuardFoundation.org to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Another one to check out is the Always Ready Collective, which delivers art by and for some daring fighters of the sea. Head over to Etsy, Facebook, or Instagram and search Always Ready Collective to check out their Coast Guard and Maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. You won't be disappointed. Anyone who gets one of their designs inked on their body will get featured on their feed and can be sent a care package on the house. Find a design you like, some blank canvas, and get it done.
Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up on social media and at theyhadtogooout.com.
Subscribe, like, comment, share, and review so we can keep this momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Be sure to look for our next episode.
Until then, fair winds and following seas.